From the Heights in Northern Manhattan, welcome to Inwood Artworks On Air. It's where I meet musicians, filmmakers, writers, theater makers, and artists of all stripes who make their home what we affectionately call Upstate Manhattan. I'm your host, Aaron Sims. Today, we welcome art conservator and fundraiser Susan Matheson. Susan has worked as an art conservator in both the United States and Europe, and as a fundraiser for museums, universities, and other historical agencies. Her extensive museum career started at the Morgan Library when she was still in high school. As a textile conservator specializing in tapestries, she worked at the Smithsonian Institution, the National Gallery of Art, the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, and Via La Pietra in Florence, Italy. She transitioned to fundraising during her tenure as administrative conservator at the Conservation Center at NYU. She has also held development positions at the American Museum in Britain, Meet the Composer, and the American Academy in Rome. In 2007, she founded SAM Fundraising Solutions, a consultancy specializing in fundraising for art conservation and historic preservation, assisting European organizations with their American Friends groups. Her clients include UK and English Heritage, the American Friends of the London Philharmonic Orchestra, the National Museum of Scotland, and in the US, the René and Chaim Gross Foundation and the Merchant's House Museum. She has served on several boards and is currently a member of the Metropolitan Museum's Textile Conservation Lab Visiting Committee. She is currently working on a book that explores careers and culture. We are thrilled about having her today to talk about fundraising and so much more. But first, let me welcome you, Susan, to Inwood Artworks On Air. It's so great to have you here.
Well, it's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I don't think we need to have a podcast now. We've talked about everything in your bio. It's like they can go find you everywhere and all these websites. You're everywhere. Always fundraising, but seriously though, you've made quite a mark on arts and culture and this cultural mecca of Manhattan and overseas. And
yeah, one tries. I'm empire building.
Yes, well, we're thrilled to have you here.
Thrilled to be here.
Could you share with our listeners how your love of conservation led you to being an established fundraiser for arts and culture institutions?
Oh, every career has a weird trajectory, and mine's no different. But when I was at NYU, the position had the title of administrative conservator, but I was a senior administrator for the department. And a substantial part of my job was fundraising for the department. I wrote the grants and that kind of thing. And when that ended, that's a long, painful story that you know, and I'm not going
to get... That's a separate podcast.
Yeah, that can go on forever. I realized, as I think a lot of people do, that I didn't want to go back to what we refer to as the bench. And I didn't want to go back to restoring or conserving tapestries, which is what my specialty was. A lot of it had to do with the way that where the field was going. It was getting much more scientific based, much more analytical, equipment based, technical art history, as it's called. And that's not my strength, and nor is it my interest. I came into conservation from the craft side of things. But it also, goes to playing up to your strengths. That's not where my strengths were. My strengths were in administration. And since part of my job was fundraising, and I liked it, I was like, all right, well, I can pivot and go this way and see where it goes. And, I took on a few development jobs to get the street cred, basically, and then laid the groundwork while I was at the American Academy in Rome got a few client contracts under my belt and was able to leave and hit the ground running. And it's been a great time ever since, because what I'm finding is that I can be a better advocate for historic preservation and art conservation through the work I do now. I can be far more creative than I ever was. And it's really, what interests me is really about how to tell the story. And, this is something you and I have discussed where it's, we need to really talk about different narratives and that kind of thing. And that's, what I like. That it's putting that spin on a conservation project or a building restoration project or something like that.
Yeah, you said it really beautifully, and I got put it down into a chestnut of like, you're an advocate for arts. Like, you get to be an advocate in the way you want to advocate. Mm-hmm. And framing the narrative is important. I love the word frame. You said earlier, because that's how it is. Like, you're literally chiseling away and showing people what they need to see in order to take action, mm-hmm. whether it's through funding or some kind of raising a flag so people take notice, so it can have perhaps it needs saving. Conservancy is to hold world into itself, and fundraising is inherently linked, obviously, because one cannot conserve without capital to do so. Mm-hmm. You've had many proud moments, and I think moving it forth, having known you through many years, are there any particular proud moments in your consultancy career that you can check the box, celebrate that? Because you said you've been able to advocate and frame successfully and to bring, throughout, particularly in the historical heritage side of things, I think you've had a lot of victories.
I've had a lot of victories. And what I think, it's not my victories. Let's start by saying that. I do not view fundraising. I'm not one of those fundraisers that walk around and go, well, I raise this and I raise that.
Right.
That's neat. Fundraising is a team sport. And so, all the things, people behind me when I'm working, it's a collective. And I'm just sort of the project manager guiding the way. But I work with major organizations, but I work with a lot of small grassroots groups. And one of my earliest clients was the Friends of Connectqua, small grassroots groups, Friends of a State Park. And they had some really lovely historical sites in the park. And it was working with them over the years and there was a colonial grist mill. Colonial, I say that, but it was one of the original buildings on the grounds. And the Connectqua State Park was a colonial site. It had a colonial tavern and the grist mill, and eventually evolved into the Southside Sportsman's Club, which is where all your Gilded Age notables, the boys, all went to hang out and go fishing and all of that. It's one of the finest trout fishing sites in the country, I believe, at least used to be. So, this little grassroots groups that had an operating budget of like $12,000 a year, we raised over $1 million to restore this grist mill. And it was, just through perseverance and patience and me managing the projects and some really wonderful people I worked under. But to be able to help that little group make such a mark within the park. And now it's a historic site that people can go see and, wander around and get a taste of history.
Well, I'm glad you said that and you started off. And thank you for framing what I said in a better way about that. You are a team leader, like you're a project head cheerleader, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But organizing it towards, everyone coming together, and you're the one pushing it towards getting there. But listen, other people have to do the work. They have to get out there and they have to be apostles for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great thing to take away from this conversation, is that it's not, we hire a grant writer and then we just, here's the boilerplate information. This is our mission. This is our programs. And magically you expect funds to enter your bank account. That is rarely the way things get done. It takes a groundswell, like you said. It's a groundswell of support, and it takes a lot of wonderful conversations and moving that, again, going back to storytelling, grant writing, fundraising, conservancy. It's storytelling and how how you're positioning that storytelling as advocacy to get what you want.
Exactly. And that's the thing, too, as you and I have talked about, is it's not just the same old, same old. It's you really have to be attuned to what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And what, like right now, it's, there's impact investments going on. And you have to be aware of what the donors want, where the donors are.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's also, correct me if I'm wrong, a pitfall again. It's like, this is what we do. Why aren't we, I hear this from a lot of people from, I lead a small organization, as everyone knows, called Inwood Artworks, growing every day. And this is part of our advocacy, this program. We started this program to advocate for, guess what? For other people who need advocating for. This is free PR, folks. But it's also a wonderful platform for people to get the word out about what they do and also start conversations, I hope, or maybe end a few. And I think that, kind of getting back to what I really want to say is that you have to be able to put yourself out there, and you can't expect your program to just speak for itself for all time. Like, this is what we do, and mm-hmm. we're not changing with the times. So unfortunately, yes, you have to have strong programming, right?
Yeah.
But also, you know, you have a great wealth of experience, pun intended, to create story-driven appeals to fundraisers, donors, grant makers. Mm-hmm. And as we take the temperature, we'll say, of the current grant-making scene, you know, can you specifically speak a bit about what areas of interest are trending? Because the word is trending right now, because it seems like they all get together in a room every year, decide what we're going to really lean towards. And the buzzwords this year are we want to see what we want to see, mm-hmm. but not just for words' sake. And because it's all about allocations, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's the pool of money. Mm-hmm. And we're deciding where that money, that pool goes.
Exactly.
So where is it trending now?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is COVID, if you want to look at it that way, and the recession of 07, 09 were both sort of disruptions. And how do you deal with those disruptions? And what has come out of COVID, you know, we're bouncing back, but we're not bouncing back as fast as we thought we were. And so what we're seeing is that it's not about art for art's sake anymore. And that narrative really has to change. And you know, between the cities cutting arts funding, you know, the states kind of doing weird things now. You know, several of the main arts foundations are sort of saying, oh, maybe we don't want to do this anymore. I mean, so you're really kind of having to say, okay, well, how do we fit into this so we can advocate for arts? We can show the importance of the arts within the city, the state, whatever. But it's going back to looking at that narrative. And right now, you know, everyone's jumping on the economic impact bandwagon. And yes, that's important. But I'm seeing there are other ways to show the importance of arts. It, you know, there's the mental health and you know, how we fit into health and human services. You know, how do we fit into education? How do we fit in here, there, and everywhere? And that sort of thing. So what you're doing, and even when I talk to conservators about funding for conservation, I'm like, it's not about that object. It's about what happens to that object after it's been conserved, after it's been restored. How is it used to educate? How is it used to engage the community? How is it used to engage the audience? Which are two separate things.
And these should all be in your application, by the way.
Exactly. So you really have to think how to broaden the impact of that performance, that dance piece, that theater piece, that poet, you know, that poetry slam,
right,
or what have you. And I'm not saying any of those arguments are no longer important. They're all important. I mean, if you look of the contribution to the arts in the national GDP, it's huge.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at it in terms of the city, it's huge. And a lot of people don't get it. So you do have to say, okay, yeah, we're putting on this major exhibition of X, but this is what it's going to do beyond that. And that's where the creativity comes in, because it's not just about hitting those usual arguments, it's finding out what's different. And that's what, I recently had a meeting with a client, and we were talking about a collection digitization. And they, you know, I was like, okay, well, give me the impact. You know, what do you foresee the impact of this being? And, you know, it gave me the you know, well, it's access to the collection, you know, online and all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's what everybody's saying. What's unique about this collection in particular, and why is making it accessible to the larger public outside of New York important?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I feel like there's such a focus on the doing of the program, less about the impact of the program.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, and I use program very judiciously,
yeah.
I think it's a big issue right now, and I'm curious about your various clients and you present that, what about collectively, what about them, just kind of like devil's advocate for a second, what is it about them that funders don't get?
Oh, That's a hard one. Because, you know, the typical funders do get it. And the usual suspects, as I call them, particularly in the field of conservation, they do get it. But what you're seeing now in, like, you know, with our mayor, and, you know, not so much the current head of the arts, the council's arts commission or whatever.
DCLA.
Not DCLA. It's Carlina Rivera's.
Oh, gotcha.
Within the council. Okay. You know, they get it. O'Shea before her.
I see.
Got it. There is that, and it goes back to, and this is a case with a lot of people, that sort of preconceived notions about arts or about a particular arts organization. Oh, well, they're wealthy. They don't really need the money. Or, you know, they have all this other support. They're okay. And that's not always the case. I just saw the art newspaper came out yesterday or the day before that a lot of museums are letting staff go now because, the general operating support, as we all know, is impossible to fundraise for. So it's... it's like you either have to make staffing program specific or you lose. So it's what they're not getting is the need for the funding because a lot of organizations are preconceived as being quote unquote wealthy and they're not.
Let's just face it, administrative salaries are not sexy.
No, they're not. Oh, hell no.
They are not
and
sexy.
They're not sexy. And you're getting younger generations coming up who are fighting for a livable wage. And you don't blame them.
You don't blame them. But I also feel, too, correct me if I'm wrong on this, that the starting salaries are incredibly, well, I think it's a funding problem as well. It's like mm-hmm. the younger generations are coming out of these very expensive programs that have... told them, promised them jobs after they leave their program. Let's face it, education is the biggest business there is.
Yeah.
And they're expecting these ginormous salaries for starter salaries coming out of a 4-year program or a master's program. And I hate to say it, it's a trickle down because the funding's not there to support those positions. And so you're losing, well, we are losing perhaps some really great people starting mm-hmm. out and who have to pivot and go in other sectors.
Yeah.
And also the organizations are either they're not getting the support they need to create the work and support the programs they need to get out there for these said audiences.
Exactly. And for the impact.
Yeah.
And there isn't the trickle concept of trickle down in particular. And I come from a museum background, so that's what I tend to speak to. It's not there as much as you would think. I mean, there was when I was coming out of my program, and, you know, it was the, you're doing this for the love of it, you're not doing this. And what I give them credit for is the students coming out now are like, I have trained, I'm educated. I want to be able to pay rent, eat, and do what I want to do and love. And, you know, that, like I said, I give them credit for fighting for it, but it is hard because you are losing. And this goes to, as well, my sort of premises, as you well know, of a lot of us in arts careers need to rethink what it means to be in our chosen profession.
Well, I think that's a great lead into my next question, which is, what are the common pitfalls that artists and arts orgs make in their appeals for funding?
Oh, I think the first thing, and this even goes back to the last point, is data. Bring in the data. You really need. I mean, every year when I do the New York State Historic Preservation Grants and through the CFA, the Consolidated Funding Application, I spend a solid month doing research. And I do 3 or 4 of them a year. This is why I don't sleep in June and July. And it is... all of that data, back it up. Say, you know, and there's some really great programs out there. There's one through the Institute of Museum and Library Services that really shows you how to quantify and qualify, because you have to do both, the data. And be able to say, you know, we served X number of people with this program. With your funding, we can serve this many more. and this is the demographic of our community, so this is who we're serving. And, you know, we are in, like, yeah, we may be Soho, NoHo, West Village, whatever, but there's actually a huge poverty contingent in each of those, what are perceived as very wealthy neighborhoods. So if you're able to say X percent of this community lives below the poverty level, that makes a much stronger case than, you know, we really want to do this fun education program because it would be really good to bring into, you know, the local schools, some of which are private schools and equally affluent. But it's like, no, we're serving these kids who are, you know, living with, you know, under poverty, or we're doing dual language things. So because we have X percent in the NIC community that speak another language at home.
Well, I think data is, it's a never ending saga, I mm-hmm. think, for people. And I, again, it comes back to, I'm linking it back to our conversation about having enough administrative people to do the work
yeah.
as well.
And that's why consultants.
But tracking, that's exactly right. Here we go. See what I did there, bringing it all together.
A lovely segue. I love it.
We try. Well, if you had a crystal ball, and I know you do because I've seen your apartment. crystal clean it actually is. Mm-hmm. Where do you see the emphasis and funding in the forthcoming years by the municipal state, the big dudes, NEA, et cetera, so on?
Oh, God, who knows? Well, right now, what's interesting is the president, back in the fall, I think it was, has done an executive order, that's what it is, saying that he wants to see more arts incorporated across federal government. So it's not just your NEA, your NEH, your IMLS, or your Department of the Interior, which is the Parks Department, or DOE, the Department of Ed, it's everywhere. So there has to be that bit of arts component to what they do, or consideration of the arts to what they do. So I think that is going to be interesting to see, because I think that will also open possibilities for additional funding. And hopefully will trickle down stateside. I know Hochul, in her last thing, introduced the Ars Pluribus Unum program that is about creative placemaking. So, but I haven't seen any funding for that yet. So I think there's, you know, it's going to be, again, it goes back to that, and I've been saying this since like 2010, is really rethinking how you're presenting it and how it fits into the greater good, into the greater community.
Well, and I'm going to zoom out with that question, to that answer, because you're talking about, again, focusing on your community and you're pinpointing it straight to it. And how, but the whole point is that, how do we get there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so as times evolve, could you speak throughout your, and also from your vast experience with these organizations, how necessary strategic planning is for organizations large and say from the top to the grassroots, you know, to keep their programming relevant and, you know, mission driven?
The thing about strategic planning is everyone jumps on that bandwagon. And, you know, I've facilitated them, so I'm no different. But you need to make sure you're not creating a laundry list or to-do list. It's because that's not what strategic planning should be about. It should be about looking at the outside and what you as an organization is going to do to either solve problems, to combat whatever needs combating, all of that. So it's not always an internal looking, it's also an external looking. And, you know, we can talk about SWOT analysis, which is part of it, but that's, you know, that's where I think a stronger strategic plan comes from. And one of my clients did this recently, where they really did look, you know, about issues of diversity and all of that, and collections, and where, you know, it fit in within the community and what the programs should be to better serve that community. And I think that should be a major part of any strategic plan, particularly these days, because you're finding more and more funding is wrapped around DEI or DEIA, whatever you want to call it. And so you're if you're able to say, well, hey, we've been, you know, this is part of our strategic plan. We've been doing it. Here are our successes. Here's how many served. We've got to go back to that data. And then you're able to create a much stronger case to justify that funder funding you. And that's what it really boils down to, is you're not just looking at what you do. It's looking at what they want to do. And, you know, how do you help them fulfill their mission? It's that kind of quid pro quo in a way. So you know, if you're looking at, you know, they want to do X, Y, and Z. Well, okay, well, what are you doing that's going to help them fulfill X, Y, and Z? So I think there's, you know, a lot of that. And I think, yeah, did that answer your question?
It does answer my question. There's a lot of that should be the answer for all your questions, all my questions, I think. But thanks for addressing it, because it feeds, because it's slightly different than things we talked about earlier. That's why I wanted just to bring it up, because it's your approach. It's like zooming out and seeing the wider picture of not just, it's saying like it's looking at your organization as a whole.
Yeah.
And then and putting the pieces. That's why I say that question kind of last.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing the trending and fundraising. You're seeing what you do well, what you don't do well, the data analysis, and kind of saying, where does that all fit in? And also, it's okay to stop doing a program.
Yeah.
It's okay to even close an organization. Nonprofit missions are sometimes not met for a reason.
Yeah.
That I'm saying anyone to close their show.
No. But mergers.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and co-productions and finding what you can do, and you know, there's a lot of great help. And when I will say on the side too, is that, you know, who can help you that also needs help?
Well, and I am such, as you well know, such a huge advocate for partnerships, and I do that a lot with particularly my European clients, mostly UK, you know, who are coming over here like English Heritage, and looking to build. You know, it's not always about a donor base. It's about raising awareness. I mean, you know, English Heritage it's 427 sites throughout England, including Stonehenge. You know, so yeah, everybody knows Stonehenge. Everybody knows Osborne House in the Isle of Wight. Everyone knows Dover Castle, all really cool sites. But there are all these other amazing sites. And you have Americans going through. We are one of the largest tourist constituencies in the UK. But it's like, look, you can go here too and here too. So it's really about introducing them to the American audience. You know, yes, they want to raise money, but they're also going to increase their earned revenue, because people are going to go over there and visit the various sites. So, and the way to do that is to partners with other organizations. I mean, all the Anglo-American groups, we all know each other, we all work together. But it's also, too, finding other organizations that might be good partners to introduce. You know, and you're not pilfering. That's always the other big.
Yeah.
You're not.
I think you learn fast who does that.
Yeah, you're not pilfering. And someone said that to me very early on. He's like, no. He's like, if a donor or someone is interested in something, they're not going to just join one organization. They're going to join multiple ones. So, yeah.
High tide raises all boats.
Mm-hmm.
Very much so.
Very, very much so. So, yeah. So it's a very effective way to audience build, you know, particularly for them over there coming here. And it's worked really well. I mean, I've taken organizations with a couple of hundred on their list to a couple of thousand. You know, it's about taking the time, making the commitment to it. But yeah, it can be very successful.
Well, you mentioned a lot of ways you can be successful in your newsletter, which is part of your business. And so you talk a little bit, you publish a newsletter, you create this wonderful resource, and we've covered some of the topics today. And how can they be a part of that newsletter?
Oh, all you have to do is email me.
And your website is?
My website is samatheson.com, and there is a contact box in there. But yeah, you can also email me at susan@samatheson.com. And yeah, the newsletter, I try to do it quarterly. It doesn't always work out, but it's really things that are intriguing to me. Right now, I tend to do a lot of research in the background, and right now I'm looking at fixed and growth mindsets. in terms of both organizational growth and also career growth. So that may be the next one.
All right, folks, you just got a preview. So I want to thank you again, Susan, for being a guest and coming
thank
on here.
You.
I think you've enlightened a lot of souls. And
please
reach out to her if you have any questions on your own.
Absolutely.
Once again, thanks to Susan Matheson for joining me on this Artist Spotlight episode of Inwood Artworks On Air. It's where we meet the musicians, writers, filmmakers, theater makers, and artists of all stripes, including those who fundraise, here in Upper Manhattan. If you have a moment, please show us some love and rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts 5 stars. Many thanks to Hudson View Gardens for hosting us and to Heightsights.com for Uptown promotional support. You can support On Air and all of our programming, speaking of, by making a tax-free donation at inwoodartworks.nyc/donate or via Venmo at Inwood Artworks. Be sure to follow us on social media and keep up all that we do, which includes the Inwood Film Festival, Filmworks Al Fresco, live performances, and so much more. Inwood Artworks On Air is proud to be supported in part by public funds from the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs in partnership with the City Council. And Inwood Artworks programming is made possible by the New York State Council on the Arts with the support of the Office of the Governor and the New York State Legislature. From the top of Manhattan and the bottom of our hearts, thank you so much for tuning in. This is Aaron Sims for Inwood Artworks On Air.